To say, turning to Ezra and continuing here as his story unfolds. There's something about the history of Israel that is a very important warning. I think we might be inclined to think that when things are good, it's then that we'll be very thankful and we'll remember God, remember to sing his praises. But we live in a world today, too, where there are many who suffer for the faith that they testify. And at times, when we do get a glimpse of them, they seem, you might say, much closer to God, more mindful of God and his help. In the history of Israel, more often than not, when things were going well for them, they tended to forget God. But when it was when things turned bad, when things turned tough, it's then that they did think of him and cry out to him, and much of the time did gain help from him. I would therefore recommend, and I have recommended, and I would continue to recommend, that when you know what you might call sunny days in your life, that you be sure to practice your faith. It's a bit like at this time of year, or in this particular weather that we've been having, when there is a sunny day, except for a Sunday, that you take the opportunity and cut the grass, for example. But when we have a sunny day, that we make sure we practice our faith, look at the things that are good, and exercise ourselves to recognize God in those, in his work, in his provision. And we should make special effort, I think, to talk about it, to examine our hold on Christ. Not examine our faith as such, but to make sure that we have a sure hold on him, the person. Hebrews 10 talks about that from verse 19, where we're called, we're assured that we have access to God through Christ, but he goes on and he says, hold fast your confession, and he goes on and he says, therefore, come together, make sure you're often together, that you encourage one another in these things. Now, when we do that, when we may talk about it, when we might talk about it together, when we might speak of it ourselves, may at times be something of the feeling that it's just words. You say just how amazing God has been. And we should. Something you have really wanted perhaps has worked out for you in what you can recognize to be an amazing way. Speak about it. And I put it that way because that's what Ezra did. He did it in chapter 7 regarding the support that the king, Artaxerxes, had given to him in that letter that he was going to carry with him. He tells us about it. He lays it all out. And he says, well, look at what God has done. God's good hand has been upon us, upon him, upon myself, he says. And by that work, Ezra recognized that not only did he have the human king's support, Artaxerxes' support, but he also had God's sovereign support working in and through Artaxerxes. So he talks about it. He tells how God has been good, and in that way cultivating his own faith, but also all who will listen to him. Now, it's reached so far, he has the letter in his hand, he has the permission to go, and he has authorization to take quite a bit of stuff with him. But now, what about the journey, and what about what was ahead once he did eventually reach Jerusalem, assuming he does reach Jerusalem? How is Ezra going to get there, and what will he find? How will he handle it? We see just the first of those things in chapter 8, and other questions in the following chapters. How well will Ezra's fair-weather faith hold out where he did receive that great work through the king. How well will his faith hold out through what lies ahead of him? But not only that, how infectious will his faith be? What impact will it have on the people around him? Surely there will be testing times ahead. And don't get me wrong, I do believe that the reason Ezra recognized how remarkable this was with Artaxerxes was because it must have been a testing time, waiting, asking for that authorization, waiting for it, and just how would it turn out. But when there may be testing times ahead, how will Ezra approach those times, those events? And I ask that question because it is to seek instruction for ourselves for any testing times that may be before you, and those that you might look back on and reflect on as well. And I would suggest that we recognize that this chapter is well understood by seeing that Ezra is here showing the benefits of living by faith. In all the things that we have in this chapter, this is a steady theme that runs through it. He goes on in what he does here, expecting, and he also receives God's care and God's provision. We see that in what, maybe seen as four main elements. I would suggest we might bring them under three headings. First of all, the things that are gathered, there's the men that are gathered and the gifts that are gathered in two parts. And then I want to highlight one thing that he especially speaks about and under the heading of ashamed. And then thirdly, he is preserved. So first of all, the things that are gathered, then not to be ashamed, and that he is preserved. So gathered, first of all, I would gather two passages that are separate in the text, but both of them are God's provision for the journey. There are the men, and there are the goods, or the provisions. The men are there from verse 1 through to verse 20, the provisions, the gifts, from verse 24 through to 30. And there seems to be a hint in the words here that this gathering of people, it rests on the end of chapter 7, verse 28. I was encouraged as the hand of the Lord my God was upon me, and I gathered chief men of Israel to go up with me. And it seems to flow out of his personal encouragement. But he was so encouraged that he couldn't stop talking about it. You can almost picture that, and that he took that encouragement. Nehemiah did something similar. He took that encouragement to others, and he said, look what God's been doing. Look what I have from this great king. Won't you come with me? God's good hand has been upon me. And he gained chief men, leading men of Israel. Some of these names you might know. We read into verse 2, sons of Phinehas, Gershom of the sons of Ithamar, Daniel, Phinehas, Gershom, Ithamar were all priestly names. We see two of the sons of David. And it is obviously generations down from these initial names. But many of them you will not know, most likely. And yet they were leading men of the time, of those who were in Babylon. The numbers of men that we have listed here, the males that are numbered, comes just short of 1,500, 1,500, and the list that we have there in the first verses are 12 clans. Not likely to be of the 12 tribes of Israel. These were from Babylon, and the northern tribes, the 10 northern tribes, had been scattered much further afield some years before. But there were 12 clans, it seems, of named by their forefathers and 1,500 initially, at least. These were males. They would have people with them. And Ezra has this lovely little note as he speaks about their fast and what they were seeking from the Lord, the right way for us and our little ones. So there were families going, so more than 1,500 all told. So far so good, but when they did convene at the river to prepare for the journey, Ezra discovered a notable absence, missing Levites. No servants for the house of our God, in verse 17. This is what he was looking for. No Levites. There were some who had gone on before, although very few then as well. Of all the numbers who had gone that we learn of in chapter 1 verse 40 tells us there were 74 Levites among 42,000 who were numbered to go back to Babylon in the first wave. And does this perhaps indicate some reluctance for the Levites? We've touched on this previously. But were they reluctant to go back to the... They were servants. It was perhaps not a very glamorous role. They would do the hard work. Maybe they had been more comfortable. The Levites were very scattered around the area. They didn't have the same kind of settled community that many of the other people had. They were to be spread around from way back in the days of Joshua. But were the Levites reluctant to serve God? But with a special appeal, with some arrangements made, Ezra was very shrewd. He took several leading men of understanding, and approached the right man at the place where, especially where the Nethinim were. These were servants of the Levites, it seems, further down in verse 20. The Nethinim are generally supposed to be from outside of Israel, initially at least. But it was the Levites in particular that were needed, and one does respond. And we learn Sherebiah in verse 18 was a man of understanding. It seems to have taken a particular grace to bring these few Levites forward. There were 38 of them after this appeal from just two families within the Levite tribe, and they brought with them a larger number of Nethinim. But at least there were some, and Ezra seems to have been satisfied with that, and he did get good men of understanding. And Ezra's response to this is, as his response has so often been thus far, that he put it down to God's good hand upon us. It wasn't his organizational skill, it wasn't his motivational abilities, it wasn't simply that he had a great story to tell of his personal encouragement, but he saw this change, this hauling out of the Levites who had been reluctant before. They didn't volunteer. He realizes that this is God's good hand. God has been at work, and he recognizes this to be God, which is an act of faith in itself. He was active himself. He did set about this in an active way. He knew they needed Levites. This was already part of God's revealed will, servants of the house of God. But when he sees these new men come to him, Sherebiah with his sons and brothers, 18 of them, Hashabiah and another 20, when he sees them come, it's the way that he attributes their change of heart to God, God's work. It's the insight of faith. And that's something that is important for us to exercise ourselves. Whether it's God's provisions, as with the gifts for the temple in a moment, or such things as these, where men's hearts are changed. Don't be slow to recognize that God does these things. Many of these things are way beyond just the natural man. So there were men needed, and there were also gifts needed. Gifts had been appointed by the king. Ezra provides, you might say, a simple accounting statement. He lists the articles that were given by the king and his counselors and princes, and also by Israel. It says those present. Does that just mean the 1,500 that he was taking with him, plus by this time 260 temple servants? Or perhaps were there other Israelites nearby who had come to see them off, as it were? Others who were present, possibly, and making a contribution. But there too, I think we see the eye of faith on events and on these provisions, and on the people that he commissions to take care of them. From verse 28, you are holy to the Lord. This is not just a routine exercise. It's not just a quartermaster or a logistical expert getting skilled men, but he says that what matters here is that you are holy to the Lord. That too is a matter of faith. The articles are holy also. They have come from the king. They were not holy to the God of Israel initially, but they were made holy by being devoted to the Lord. The insight of faith again. The stewards of these things are holy. And it's a wonderful way too that he expresses this, that there's a great confidence that they will take them to Jerusalem, they will reach there, and they will hand them over to the responsible people. Again, the testimony of faith. I think the faith that Ezra has is especially evident in verses 21 to 23. And this is, I put it under the heading of ashamed, because that's the outstanding word, in a way, in those verses, the way that Ezra picks up on that. I find it one of the more unexpected takes on things that we find in the Bible. Paul, for example, he talks about not being ashamed of the gospel, Romans 1:16. When we speak to our young people, or anyone for that matter who is going out in the world, we would encourage folk not to be ashamed of Jesus. Jesus is the one who is mocked very often in the world. The Bible is dismissed all around them. Not to be ashamed of him or his word. Jesus gave the warning that if any of us should be ashamed of him and his words in our day, the time will come when he will be ashamed of us when he returns. So there are such expressions that we find in the Bible and need to be very much aware of. Don't be ashamed of God. But Ezra's way of looking at it is slightly the other way round, if you like. He was concerned not to put himself in a position where he would be ashamed, and that position would be if he accepted the king's offer of an escort of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy on the road. If he accepted that, he says, I would then be ashamed. I was ashamed to request these things. It would be a cause for shame if I received that offer. He's not saying don't be ashamed of trusting in Jesus. He is saying be ashamed instead of saying you do trust in God, but then to put your trust in men. But you've said, you've given a testimony that I trust in God. You're not ashamed in words and the words that you speak, but then the way that you live that follows through. He has made a testimony. He has said that the reason he would be ashamed in this case is because we had spoken to the king saying, the hand of our God is upon all those who are good who seek him, but his power and his wrath are against all those who forsake him. You can't fault that statement. It was superbly put. But Ezra's concern is that it will not just be the words of his mouth. The things that he knows in his mind, to be true that he has spoken, perhaps in a quieter moment. Now the crux comes, the crunch time. This is when it's really going to be testing. Will he go through with it? They're just about to set out on a journey which everyone knows is a dreadful journey. Every possibility of danger. Is he going to hold to his word? He says, I would be ashamed not to. So it does come back in many ways to those other examples that Jesus talks about. But it's not just about the words that we speak. We must be sure that every part of us, our words and our life, does not put shame upon him. And how many times have people, men, have you, maybe slipped into something like that without realizing it? Ezra was sharply aware that there should be no inconsistency in his words and his life. The king probably made a very well-meant offer of an escort. He would have known what was ahead of these few people. Not a very big number. But Ezra said, if now I was to go ahead and ask and accept the king's offer, or to make a request of the king, then it would destroy everything. That would be a reason, genuine reason for shame. So what he does instead is to call for an exceptional spiritual exercise with the people that have gathered, which is to fast and to humble themselves and to pray, to entreat our God for this, in verse 23. They're asking for God's leading for their journey, that it is they would not rely on what the king would provide. There are many people who would look at that in our world and would say Ezra was being very foolish to say something like that when surely he knew that there were great dangers ahead. Why did he cut himself off, as it were? And was he just being stubborn to follow it through? Did they have any second thoughts later? Well, certainly the question was in front of Ezra. What did the king think? Did he think that these people were being very foolish? What about the other Israelites who stayed behind? Was that part of the reason for them staying behind? This new man wasn't going to take protection. We can't afford that. But this is the great thing about Ezra's faith and the way that he led the people in faith. These people did depend on God. They followed through on their testimony. They were consistent. They maintained that consistency. Yes, perhaps it was stimulated in to some measure by shame. But that brought about something good. They did follow through on truly trusting in God's care. How often have otherwise professing believers at times held back on testimony? Maybe we've weighed things up, or we've tested the wind, we've evaluated the hazards first before we've put the mark down. Even in our words, we mostly won't know what's ahead of us. And in a sense, that's what I'm doing myself just now. I do not know what's ahead of us in the next minute. But I'm appealing to you to put yourself firmly in the path of faith. What other answer is there? And then I must be consistent. But I must not be ashamed. You must not be ashamed. Why do we not more often affirm, openly affirm, what we say we know to be true in the easier moments of our lives? And if we say anything, let us be ashamed of going back on that witness. But because they had made that commitment, They made it in word, then they made it in their action by relying upon God, turning away from any reliance upon the king. But because of all this, they then turned to fasting and prayer. You might remember that Jesus once answered his disciples they couldn't cast out a demon, and they asked him why not, and he said that can only be cast out by prayer and fasting. It is an exercise to draw very close to God and to humble ourselves. And that humbling is to say to God, we know that only you can deal with this matter. And that's what Ezra testifies to further, that having fasted and entreated, that God answered our prayer. And then you would be, advised to take a moment and to say to Ezra, how do you know God answered your prayer? And this is the last part, where they did then depart from the river of Ahava, and they were preserved and reached Jerusalem. Just one verse tells us that. There's a similar verse that in the beginning of chapter 7, the summary of Ezra's appearance and life, and it tells you in very brief words that they set out and they came to the other end. The prayer that they offered had been to know which was the right way to journey to Jerusalem, the best way. For these males that are listed, their little ones, and for the things that they had to take. The right way, that would be related to how do we deal with the possibilities of enemies and ambush on the road. There may not have been any options on the route, but what is the way that we're going to go about this? Maybe more what's in mind. But as Ezra reports this sequence of events, he's able to say that God answered our prayer. That was what they prayed for. That prayer was answered. They were preserved. Verse 31, the hand of our God was upon us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambush along the road. And so there is that record of God's preserving of them. That was what they had sought. That's what was given to them. But when did Ezra know that they were preserved? This would have been a record after the event. So that would be the how he can write this. But he didn't know the way that we often think of knowing before they set out. They knew that God answered the prayer by the time they reached the end of the journey in Jerusalem. What evidence is there that God has answered prayer? It's when you have done what you have asked him to help with. You may have some note of assurance of some kind. You may believe that God has said to you, yes, I've heard your prayer. He had said that to Daniel, for example, but the outworking of that answer was still to come. But Ezra could only finally say God answered our prayer once he had stepped out on that 12th day of the first month from the river of Ahava. Do you remember when the people of Israel had to cross the River Jordan under Joshua? And the way that was to be done was that the priests were to take the Ark of the Covenant, and they were not just to walk to the edge of the water and see God open the water and then step in. They were to step into the river. And that was for them, they were under test to say, do you trust in God's word? God said, I will open the river. You step in and see him open the river. Ezra, we have prayed, we have asked our God for this, we have made that testimony, we set out on the road trusting that God will complete what we believe is honoring to him, trusting in him, that trust that they exercised. the answer that God gives to that prayer comes when it came, when they stepped out. It comes when you step out. And you do go on. And you wait to see him complete that work that he gives you to do. So Ezra is showing us his faith in a number of ways in this chapter. This is another of them. Pray and then do. There are times when there have been certain sectors of the church where there are concerns about the future of the church and what is God wanting in the church, and so there are times given over to pray for revival, which is good. But are we exercised for revival as well? Are we not only praying for it, but committing ourselves to it? Are we doing what is required of us to find that revival, or anything else that we might pray for? It is not just about praying and it's waiting to see what God will do, but he works through us. Jesus said to his disciples, pray for laborers to go out into the harvest, and he promptly sent them out into the harvest to do what they had prayed for. Ezra had openly testified to God's providential care. Maybe you've done that at times as well. Ezra had acted on that. It was still to come. He believed that God could and would do it, and so he stepped out in that faith. But he did it because he had also exercised humility before God. His great object was to bring God honor. That's why he would have been ashamed to then ask the king for help. It would be dishonoring to God. It was God first. And therefore he could expect God to demonstrate his care of his people. It's then that Ezra saw his answer to his prayer and saw God's good hand upon him. Again, that sight, that insight, that perception of faith. The passage then closes in the remainder of the chapter with several of the immediate aspects of their purpose in returning to Jerusalem, and it's really listed rather simply, quite matter-of-factly. First of all, they stayed there three days. What does that mean? I believe it means they recuperated. They gathered their resources, and what good sense that meant. After all, it had been a 3.5 month journey. Chapter 1 tells you it's a 4 month journey, but as we read in this chapter, you realize that 11 or 12 days of that first month were given over to these preparations that we've just been reading of. So the actual journey was about 3.5 months. So they rested, they recuperated, then they set about the business that had been committed to them. They delivered the articles to the temple, and it was all weighed as appropriate and checked. Then there were the offerings of the sacrifices, and these were burnt offerings, and there were also sin offerings. This was the sin offerings would cover the such sins as they might have committed along the way, but especially the burnt offerings. And burnt offerings are symbols of devotion, a full giving over. The entire animal was burnt, nothing left. And there's this very much that indication there that I'm giving my all to God. And that was the response of these people as they had been delivered on that journey. And then as well, delivering the king's orders and letters to the various governors around. And so, in his simple words, Ezra says, it was in all of these things, and coming in this way, therefore we gave support to the people and the house of God. Just these few people, 1,500 men, 1,700 and their little ones, so their families with them. They'd come through a journey, no escort, no soldiers with them. That would be remarkable in itself. And as they appeared in the city, this was great support to the people who were already there and to the house of God. I think Ezra's faith is well demonstrated, the faith of those around him as well, seen here in their perception, their seeing of God's hand, in their provisions, men's hearts moved, and goods provided. It's seen in their testimony, first in their words, and then upholding that, those words by acting on it. And they were rewarded by finding themselves answered by God under his good hand and strong hand, giving them safety. It would be a misunderstanding to think that the Old Testament is about just about adhering to the law. That in itself would be an act of faith. Faith, faithful living, trusting in God was as necessary in Old Testament days as it is now. And so we can still gain great encouragement by looking at Ezra and taking his urging that we too would trust in God, that we would testify to God, we would live out that faith. But if Ezra did that, how much more we should do it when we have so much more evidence of God's good hand. Clearest revelation we have, Hebrews tells us, is to be found in God's own Son. And if he has given his own Son to us, will he ever let down anyone who trusts in him? Let's do what Ezra did. Make an affirmation. The things we know in our hearts and our minds, let us testify in whenever we can to the strength and the grace and the love of God, his upholding. But live it out then. Let the shame be if you don't. He who is in us is so much greater than anything that the world might set against us. May the Lord bless his word, and may we have grow in understanding as he speaks with us again this evening.